Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. This is the Entrepreneur Architects Podcast with Mark R. LePage, Episode 4, Inspiring Your Everyday Success in Business, Leadership, and Life. Blue Homes has reinvented residential design with their patented folding prefab construction, offering architecture as a product. Today's guest at the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast is Blue Homes VP of Design, Carl Daubman. We talked about Carl's background, how he landed an architect's dream job at Blue, and their integrated approach to delivering custom prefab modern homes throughout the United States. If you liked Episode 1 with my friend Christopher Pollard, you're going to love my conversation with Carl. Blue is taking home construction and the business of architecture to the next level. We discussed how Blue is changing the home building industry and what architects can learn from Blue's success. So here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. Today I'm speaking with architect Carl Daubman. He's the Vice President of Design and the Creative Director at Blue Homes. Blue Homes is a company offering prefabricated modern homes. Welcome to the podcast, Carl.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me. I'm excited about what you're doing.
Thanks. Yeah, this should be a great conversation here. I want to start with talking a little bit about your background. I have a lot of younger listeners and students and recent grads, and I like to kind of start with your backstory. You know, when did you decide to become an architect, and why did you want to become an architect?
It's funny. I was just talking about this with a friend the other night because I was at dinner and someone had the opposite story of me and the same story as me. I wanted to be a car designer. And I think my guidance counselor thought that was mechanical engineering. So was pushing me down that path. And it was actually when I went and visited schools. And it's also funny because, Mark, you and I went to the same school a few years apart.
Right.
But it was when I walked through the architecture studios that I just was really excited and energized by the activity in the studio and what was going on and what was happening there. And so it was actually a pretty late decision on my part after I had already been applying to schools and applied late and got in. Luckily, and then it's kind of history from there.
And you went to Roger Williams University, right, in Rhode Island?
Yes.
And yep. And was that the first studio that you visited?
Yeah, and actually, because it was late, I think it was probably the only studio that I visited, and was just so kind of enthralled with the studio space there and the school itself and what was happening that I kind of applied there only and got in and went there.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
And I was just going to say, even maybe before that, which is kind of interesting where I've some of the work that I've done since then, I grew up in a small fabrication shop and I grew up in Rhode Island as well. And it's been kind of interesting to come back and use my practice as a way to actually be building things again in a very hands-on way. So that's kind of played itself out even before going to architecture school, and then worked for a few years and then went to MIT for grad school. And focus there on research and on computation and design.
What kind of fabrication shop did you grow up in?
It was a small sign shop, so it had everything from sheet metal work, and I worked in the graphics department for a number of years, and probably even before high school, through high school, and then even a bit in college. Some steel fabrication, welding, painting, all sorts of things. It was a pretty amazing experience to grow up around that.
Yeah. Yeah. It gives you a very good background for architecture and what you're doing now.
Yeah.
Well, where was the first place you started? Where did you start your career after you graduated MIT?
Right after MIT, I moved to Michigan on a one-year teaching fellowship, and had always been at Roger Williams, had always been around really amazing or attended classes with really amazing faculty, and many of which had their own practice on the side, and also had a realization in school that all the architects that I was really interested in were also kind of had one foot in academia. And so when I went to MIT, it was with the intention of teaching. And so started in 99 at Michigan on a one-year teaching fellowship, continued there. I was a professor of practice for a number of years, and then in 2008 got tenure. So I'm an associate professor at the University of Michigan currently.
That's great. Did you ever practice traditionally?
I had a practice from about, when I moved to Michigan, the next year I started collaborating with another.
Okay, so we've had some technical difficulties, but I think we got them fixed and wrapped up. So we were talking about traditional practice, and if you had ever practiced in a traditional practice.
Yeah. So let's see, maybe I'll back up a little bit. Just, I'm not sure where we got cut off. When I started teaching, and that was a full-time position. I also started collaborating with a fellow colleague, and we did that informally for a couple of years, and then we formalized that, and we practiced together for about 10 years. We had a practice in Ann Arbor, which would range anywhere from maybe 2 employees to maybe 5 or 6 employees. And we did residential, we did a number of commercial interiors, kind of anything. It was very local practice, but we also started acting as the contractor on the project. So I was, one of my areas of research within the school is digital design and digital fabrication. So we were using what I was teaching in school at the same time as a way to think about these things as it was applicable to mainly restaurant interiors. So we were laser cutting and bending aluminum. We were CNC milling things. We were designing and building furniture for the spaces. So it became a pretty interesting relationship between the teaching and the practice.
Did you have your own shop, or was that you using the school shop? How are you doing all that work?
The school shop was great as a way to do prototypes, and to even, we would do kind of research projects with it. But when it came time to actually deal with production level things, we had much better luck either subbing out things, because also we're close to Detroit, and there's an amazing wealth of fabricators and people around. So we could easily get things laser cut, water jet cut, milled, and then we had our own shop space, so we could be assembling those things and then bringing them to the site.
What was the name of that firm?
The name of the firm was Ply Architecture. And my partner was Craig Borum, and he's continuing with the firm. We split this past summer as a way for me to focus more on Blue Homes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into Blue Homes a little bit. What's your responsibility there first? What's your role?
It's evolved over the last few years. I started as the creative director, and now I oversee a group of about 45 designers. And the design group deals with product development, product enhancements, so kind of maintaining and developing new products. We also, there's a different set of relationships. So the potential customers meet with salespeople. When a salesperson meets with a new customer, the design group will do a kind of conceptual design, put a house on the site, customize the house, turn that around in a couple of days and give that back to the customer. So that's kind of what we call conceptual design. And then the design group also deals with the permitting and configuring a 3D model to hand off to the manufacturing team.
So it sounds very much like a traditional firm, the way it's, the early phases of the project.
Yeah. It definitely does, with probably some exceptions. Because the houses are pre-designed and pre-engineered, we also do some custom design work. So if we're going to do a house, someone might want a lower level or a custom garage or a custom connection between different mods. That is also much more like a traditional practice in terms of having to work with the client. But what's also interesting is that we're in a team. So within Blue, we have strategic development, R&D, project managers, a sales team, manufacturing team, a set crew, and the design team within that. And even within the design team, we've got a librarian, someone who's actually trained as a librarian who manages all of our specs and keeps us organized. We have a computer programmer, and a whole bunch of designers. So it's really, it's amazing to be in this kind of integrated team and to be working with everyone and sharing the goals and working toward those goals.
Sounds like a really large firm. How many people working in the firm or the company actually?
Within the company, it's right now 250. And so the design team is 45 right now within that overall group or within the overall company.
Are all the houses designed in-house or were they designed by other architects?
They're all designed in-house.
Okay.
And the reason for that is that we have a really collaborative process from working with the sales team and the marketing team at the early stages to come up with a new product, working with the manufacturing team to think about exactly how it's going to be built and how design decisions might impact both the way it works in the factory as well as the way that it's set on site. So it's always been a very difficult thing to imagine outsourcing just the design aspect of that.
Right. And I also noticed that you offer full services all the way down to, site work and installation. Your BlueServe service.
Yep. Just last year, we started a thing called BlueServe Plus. And in, I think, something like 10 or 12 different states, Blue acts as the general contractor. And it's a pretty interesting thing. From its inception, Blue has been very focused on customer experience. And one of the examples that I love as a way to describe that, and also having been involved in traditional practice for a while, it's like if you were to go to a store and buy a piece of furniture, they'd say, okay, we'll take your order, we'll start building it, and once we finish, we're not sure when we're going to finish, but once we finish, we'll tell you how much it costs. That's a little bit what I felt like I was doing as an architect, because we were, which is also why we started becoming our own general contractor as well, because when we weren't doing that, we were separated from the issues of cost, and we were separated from the issues of the methods, that the way that something would actually be built. And so BlueServe Plus was one step further for us to be able to control and develop that customer experience from beginning to end, as opposed to telling a customer, go find a piece of property, put in a foundation, and then we'll come and we'll drop the house on top of that foundation. Right now with BlueServe Plus, we manage all of those aspects.
And even the costs are even transparent. They're all published right on the website. So that's very different as well.
That's right. It's more like thinking about buying a car, that you know up front with fixed prices exactly what that's going to be. And so that's the other aspect, because we can control the cost, and we can because we manufacture the house, we know exactly what those costs are going to be. We do a bid set of drawings for subcontractors for anything that's custom. We finalize all that, and then the customer signs a contract.
How do Blue Homes compare to a traditional stick-built house as far as cost?
It's something that we're working on. It's cost per square foot is something that everyone's familiar with. The difficulty with cost per square foot is that, like on a builder to manufacturing basis, we have architects on staff, we have project managers on staff, and so obviously there's a number of services that come along with our house, but we also, when the house is delivered, it has all the appliances in it, it has everything in it, and so cost per square foot is a little bit different that way, because at least when I was doing work, the contractors wouldn't deal with things like the appliances, and then also the size of the house obviously affects cost per square foot. And so it's not a surprise that with all of the McMansions that were being built, cost per square foot became that much more prevalent, because more volume meant a lower cost per square foot. And so in a number of our houses, we're trying to do really high precision, well-built houses, but also to minimize the size of the house as a way to have less energy, less materials, less things like that. And when you have to build bathrooms and kitchens and all of those things, and you eliminate a lot of the volume and a lot of the space of the house, then the cost per square foot goes up. But what we're seeing, as our volume increases, our costs are going down. And that was something that really opened my eyes to the manufacturing process, in that we could, when our volume increases, we can start negotiating with our vendors. And we're seeing anywhere from like 20 to 40% reduction in some of our costs, because our procurement team is able to go and negotiate for things like that. So millwork, as one example, being able to shop that around, I think we saved maybe like 15 to 20% on some of our millwork. Same quality, a place that's closer to our factory, and we didn't have to change the design at all. And that's something that I think we were never really able to do as architects, to have that kind of purchasing power or have the know-how or experience to be able to negotiate that way.
How many homes a year are you building?
It's varied. I want to say, actually, I don't want to say,
because
I don't know the number off the top of my head. I think next year we're shooting to do, 125 houses. And the average cost for those, right now, our major markets are on the East and West Coast. Reasons for that are because it is more expensive to build there. In California, there's a lot of regulations, there's seismic. So it makes sense. We also have a lot of markets where the schedule is a determining factor. So Colorado is becoming an important place where in the summer we can complete the house and then it's open for ski season. But the average cost is anywhere, I want to say, from $400,000 up to $1 million. At least that's what we're seeing. And that's driven by the customer and how many mods they choose, and building compounds and building custom things. But that's kind of where the numbers
which is comparable to a stick-built house, but the, you know, the quality and the timeline is probably much better on a prefab home.
Right, and we're doing a lot of work to even pull in the schedule much more. And the other thing that's, I guess there are two things for me thinking about it in terms of our conversation as it relates to architects, were things that I didn't necessarily realize before. One is that we can do a bunch of research and development and design up front. So we go through like choosing different specs, looking at different options for the house. With our product development process, we do a bunch of research at that stage. So the standard offerings that we have for customers have been thoroughly vetted. And that's something that I felt like we were always rushed to do as architects. And I think that's an important part. The other thing that the benefit that I see is that we get an amazing amount of feedback every time we set a new house. And so we go back and we're constantly refining the process. And when I was doing one-off projects, there was always some frustration that we weren't able to refine or to build on those things. You always learn lessons, but they may not always be applicable to your next project. And so for us, when we set a house and we walk through it and the client gives feedback and we go back and talk to the client after they've lived in it a bit, we can go back and we can improve our products that way. And I think they get better and better and better. And that's a little bit different than what we're taught in architecture school, where everything has to be unique or every new project has to be different. That's something that's been very different for me to start to realize.
Do you have a specific example of something you've learned on a project like that?
It ranges in scale from, and maybe we haven't talked about Blue Homes specifically in terms of where it's situated within the prefab market. There's historically two models of prefab. One is modular, where you build big chunks of the house and then you ship them. Typically, the shipping radius for a modular company is about 250 miles. And then the other option is panelized. So you build the whole house in a factory and then you take it apart. You ship very little volume and space, but then you spend a lot of time on site unpacking those pieces and putting them back together. So Blue Homes unfold, or we fold them for shipping. So a standard module for us is about 20 feet wide. We fold the house down to 8'6" for shipping. So right now, all of our houses are built in our facility in California, and we're shipping houses across the country because we don't have oversized loads. We don't have the permitting issues. We don't have all of these things. So the house arrives on site, and typically in the fixed portion of the house, you get the kitchen, you get the bathroom, all of the things where the appliances are set, the tiles in place, the cabinetry is in place. And then the house unfolds, and that's more of the space. So that's like bedrooms, living rooms, things like that. And that's kind of the best of both worlds, so that we can ship less volume and ship more efficiently. And then once we get to the site, because of the way the houses are hinged and unfold, all of the things are kind of pre-registered and drop into place and match up. But that being said, to answer your question, the things that we learn about as we do that, constantly refining how we fold something down, how we build something in the factory, the cost difference between building something in the factory and building it on site is about 5 times different. So the people that work on site are like jacks of all trades. They're constantly improvising. They're working out things. But the more scope that we push to the factory, the better that is for everyone. So that's one aspect that we're working on. But also, as the customers live in the houses over the course of a year, we get feedback from them just about, you know, why doesn't this thing line up with that? Or when the sun comes in the morning, it's like this. Or even things like, you know, the shower. Can you guys change the way the shower works? Because I don't like the way that the water sprays, or something like that. So there's big things. And then there's also spec choices and material choices that we're getting feedback from.
Is the folding concept unique to Blue Homes?
Yes. I think that It grew out of thinking about a lot of these issues, minimizing time on site. And so what it allows us to do is to, once we set a house, and we've had some really great successes, we had the house watertight in one day. And then depending on what house it is and how many customizations and things there are, we might be on site for, could be a week, could be a couple of months, depending on, I think that's largely driven by customer, some of the customer decisions. And then the folding, we do have patents on a number of the things that we're doing. So we're also working to protect our intellectual property as well.
Could you tell me a little bit about the history of Blue Homes? How did it start? Who started it? And then how did you end up getting involved in it?
Okay. So Blue Homes started, there are three founders, Bill Haney, who is a venture capitalist, environmentalist, and a documentary filmmaker, is a really unique person with a lot of vision for these things. So he had this idea of thinking about the problem of building houses. Is seems like we're building houses the same way we have for 100 years. There's all sorts of new technologies. How do we bring that into the house? As well as from a business perspective, how do we rethink that customer experience? Along with him in those early discussions were Maura McCarthy, who has an amazing background in finance and fundraising and strategic development and thinking about all of these issues. And then also at the same time, Dennis Mashad was graduated from MIT architecture program and had been working on mass customization ideas and digital fabrication ideas. And so the three of them started having this discussion, and the company grew from there. So that's about 2008, where there's three to five employees, to now where we have 250 employees. And the reason, the kind of way that I got involved, which is pretty interesting and total luck, and the way that things work, I was teaching at the University of Michigan. I was teaching a parametric modeling seminar using CATIA. And Blue was using CATIA as a way to think about the product development and design and linking this to manufacturing. And so I think three or four of my students got hired by this company, Blue. And that was the first time that I started to hear about the company, because the students started to be snatched almost directly out of this seminar, because I think I was one of the only people teaching this software, and this was the software that they were using. And it kind of went from there. And then Maura McCarthy was in Ann Arbor interviewing students to hire at Blue. And my house in Ann Arbor has Hardy panel siding done in a kind of custom way. And Blue was thinking about Hardy siding and what they could do with it. So Maura and I got together on a Saturday morning and just started talking about things. And Blue was looking for a creative director at the time. And so conversations kind of started from there, without any expectations that I was looking for this, or that Blue would consider a creative director that was in Michigan. And it kind of grew from there. So it started as, it started from those conversations. And it was amazing that students of mine actually laid the groundwork for moving into this position.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great story. So it was founded by two entrepreneurs, not two architects, or two entrepreneurs and an architect, I guess.
Exactly. It was really interesting, coming in and meeting with Bill soon after I met with Maura. It was Blue operates incredibly fast, and so I think Maura met on a Saturday. She called me on a Tuesday. She said, "Can you be in Boston on Thursday?" And was having dinner with Bill on that Thursday night, and said, "Well, there's a long history of prefab, and to be critical of it a little bit, The problem with a lot of the prefab companies that have started and failed is that they were run by architects. And it was an interesting moment because I couldn't argue with him, knowing, and Mark, you and I were talking about this a little bit before we started, that in architecture school, we get very little exposure to business, and there's almost a kind of snobbiness to architects and wanting to not have to think about business and not have to worry about those things. And so that discussion with Bill, for me, helped me realize, one, where kind of how these things would work. And it's been a challenge, but it's also been incredibly rewarding that Blue values design. And we have conversations all the time at the management level about role design as it relates to sales. How we design the customer experience, and so it wasn't the type of thing where it was a prefab company that was all about what the thing, how it was designed or what it looked like. It was a much broader spectrum, we own and run our own manufacturing facility. That's very different from being an architecture firm that outsources the way that their houses are built. And so there's a lot of these discussions about how the business works, and what the vision is for that, which has been an amazing thing to be involved with that.
So most of the other prefab homes that have been, or the prefab companies that have started and have failed, have been launched by architects. And so what is it about Blue Home that was different, and what can architects learn from what Blue Homes has done?
It's a great question. I think from those conversations, and ongoing conversations within Blue, I think a lot of it has to do, and not all of it, but I think a big percentage has to do with understanding a market. And I say this, lovingly about architects, because I am one and I fall into this trap all the time. But I don't know that, well, there's always a contentious relationship between us as architects and our clients. And one of the things that Blue does really well is understands the market, understands where and how we position our products within those markets as a way to make it successful. And so it doesn't mean that we're not designing the things or we're not pushing the design envelope, but I think it's trying to understand both how we position them, where we position them, how we control the cost, how we understand the cost in relationship to those market issues, because you can have the best product in the world, but if it's not the right thing at the right time, then it also has the potential to fail. And I do feel like that's a big aspect of something that we maybe as architects and designers don't always concern ourselves with.
How about funding? Was the company fully funded starting up? Were there investors?
Yeah, we have some really great investors that are part of the vision of the company. We've raised $60 million in capital, and I think we're going to start another round of fundraising as a way to extend some additional initiatives, like funding some model homes so that we can get people into our houses and see the level of quality and the level of finish, as well as expanding the company and dealing with new markets. We have discussions. We're doing a couple of projects in Canada. We've recently started selling in Hawaii. For us, selling in Hawaii is a kind of test case of putting our houses into shipping containers. Once we get the houses in shipping containers, then there's all sorts of international markets that we're going to be moving to. Developers are another big part. Most, I'd say 95% of all the houses that we've built have been single-family houses for homeowners. So we're starting to work more with developers, which for us is an interesting thing. The developer has a really great understanding of their local market, and then we can bring our marketing to it. We can bring our sales understanding to it, as well as our designs. And so these are new avenues that we're looking at that I think are going to be more possible with our next round of fundraising.
Where do you imagine Blue Homes being in 5 to 10 years?
Oh, that's a difficult question. And it's difficult because we joke internally about blue years, which are kind of like dog years. The amount that we've done in 6 months or even 3 months, if I think back to some of these things, and it's difficult because a lot of us that are working lose sight of that, and we're pushing all the time. And Bill Haney is really great at saying, like, hey guys, you know, 6 months ago, this is what the company looked like. A year ago, this is what the company looked like. We're pushing incredibly hard. Every year, our sales targets double. So last year was $30 million or $35 million was our target. We sold $40 million. This year, we're going to sell $70 million. The next year, we're going to double as well. And so we're on a kind of different time cycle. And so where we are in 5 years is, for me, is really hard to predict. Even, you know, where we are going to be in a year, given how much ground we've covered in the last 6 months. But I imagine in a year that we'll be doing more work with developers. We expect our costs to drop considerably because the volume goes up and we're refining the way that we manufacture the houses. And I imagine that we have some international markets. Those are the, I think, the next three big key areas that we're going to be pushing really hard.
When you describe the company, it sounds more like a tech company than an architecture company.
Absolutely. So Bill Haney, the president and CEO, has started a number of tech companies and gone public with them. And there's definitely that aspect to what we're doing. I definitely do not describe Blue Homes as an architecture firm, more like, I don't know, at times I've described it a little bit like this notion of like an embedded journalist, that there's an embedded design team that works within there. But I think that's also not fair, because the notion of being embedded means that you're kind of an outsider that's brought in. But we're a kind of fully integrated, multidisciplinary group that I'd say designs and builds the houses. It's strange because when I talk to either new hires or I talk to the designers, I think they get a little nervous when I say it's not an architecture firm. But for me, the fact that it's not an architecture firm means that there's a lot of potential. And I'm not limited by that notion of it being or looking or feeling like an architecture firm. Being able to have a computer programmer and librarian and R&D and discussions with all sorts of other people within the company from other disciplines kind of radically changes that for me.
It sounds like an architect's dream come true, truthfully.
Yeah, it is.
I'm
really lucky.
We can kind of start wrapping it up. I would just, you know, what's a single tip that you might be able to offer to architects who want to explore alternative paths to traditional firms?
Oh, that's a really great question. There's a lot of pressure on that. Certainly with my previous firm, it felt like there were times when we were masquerading as contractors. And there's a pretty amazing entrepreneurial spirit at Michigan, where a number of the faculty are doing design build or out doing installations or doing all sorts of things. And I don't know, from the years that I've been doing this, it seems that as architects, we have a lot of opportunities and flexibility to define practice in any number of different ways. And so I guess I would just say not to be limited by what we think a certain perception of how we define our discipline might be. And also just to be curious about things, to start, you know, if you have an interest in something, pursue that, because there's the potential that that becomes a huge part of what your practice might be.
Yeah. Or a path to something completely different, something, you know, that can make you equally as happy as architecture, but may not actually be architecture.
That's right. And there's there's really great examples of people that are advocates for architecture that aren't necessarily designing things. And I do find myself often being critical of our educational system, which we've all come through, but there's a huge focus on the studio. And once you graduate, you realize that, you know, what all the time that we spent in studio, we just about dealt with schematic design. And so that's maybe 20 to 30% of what an architect does, not to mention all the other things, the history classes, the structure classes, the technology classes. All of those areas are areas that gain from having someone that understands design and understands architecture there. So I think it's great to be an architect. And I also think it's great to be an architect, or, you know, I always dream someday of being able to say, I used to be an architect and now I'm doing this. I think it lends a huge amount of credibility to what we're doing and the way that we think about the world and the way that we're able to synthesize things. But we bring a lot of value to whatever it is that we're doing, whether it's designing or whether it's something else.
Yeah, I think that once you're an architect, you're always an architect. I think whether you're practicing architecture or not, I think that once you have that background and that way of thinking, you can bring that and apply that to pretty much anything and be successful in other ventures and still be an architect.
Absolutely.
Is there any specific way some of our listeners might be able to touch base with you and just thank you for sharing with us today?
Yeah, the easiest way is to probably find me through either the Blue Homes website. My contact information is there, and certainly check out the Blue Homes website. And then you can also find me through the University of Michigan website, through the faculty directory there.
Okay, great. I appreciate your time, Carl. I think this has been a fantastic conversation. I've learned a lot.
Thank you, Mark. I'm gonna spend some time going through all of your other podcasts now. I'm really excited by what you're trying to do. And I want to keep supporting it, because I think I think architects not having a good understanding about business and about other things have held us back for a long time. And there's a lot of opportunities for us to be doing all sorts of other things if we think in an entrepreneurial way.
I agree. That's my mission. I'm going to change the world by doing that.
That sounds awesome.
All right. Thanks, Carl. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
You'll find more information about Blue Homes and Carl at entrearchitect.com/episode4. I've been busy over at the site, so while you're there, be sure to sign up for my free newsletter, the Entrepreneur Architect Report. Each week, I'll send you a quick note about what I've been doing over at my own firm, Five Cat Studio, and here at Entrepreneur Architect. I include quick links to the most recent blog post, to each podcast, and I always include some additional inspiring or useful information that you won't find anywhere else. So sign up at entrearchitect.com/newsletter, or just head over to the site and there's a form on every page. And since relaunching Entrepreneur Architect, I've received several requests for me to get deeper into the subjects I write. So I'm working on Entrepreneur Architect courses. If you're interested in learning more about the business of architecture, go to entrearchitect.com/courses and sign up. You'll be the first one to know when I launch. And if you're starting your own firm or in need of a great collection of business forms for architects, I've already launched the Entrepreneur Architect Foundations. Go to entrearchitect.com foundations, and you can get some more information there. So that's all I've got for you. I'd like to thank Carl Daubman for spending some time with us at the podcast, and a special thanks to Dana Smith of Datascope. That's Dadascope. She helped Carl and I get together, so I appreciate her help. So until next time, my name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. Thanks for listening.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.